Good day. Today is 14th May 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Well, today, 14th May 2026, we are in the middle of President Trump's visit to China. And it's been interesting to see the way in which the Chinese media have been reporting his visit. I think it's fair to say that they have not been giving the visit the kind of saturation attention that once upon a time a visit of the President of the United States to China would have received. I pointed out in my programme yesterday that at the same time as the President of the United States was visiting China, the President of the Central Asian Republic of Tajikistan was doing so as well. And rather astonishingly, the Chinese media at one point were leading with the news of the visit of the President of Tajikistan. They were actually appeared to be giving it more priority than they were giving to the visit of the President of the United States. Several people have also pointed out Larry Johnson at Sonar 21 being one, that the welcoming delegation at the airport, at Beijing Airport, that was there to greet President Trump when he came off Air Force One, that the delegation did not include Xi Jinping or other senior Chinese officials. It was apparently led either by a vice president or a vice premier, depending on which account you follow. But anyway, Xi Jinping and the very top officials of the Chinese government apparently weren't there. Now, that might, of course, have been because they were meeting with the President of Tajikistan, though I don't know this for a fact, and I'm not going to press the point of this. But anyway, it wasn't exactly a snub, but again, it did somewhat suggest that the Chinese were giving somewhat less weight to Trump's visit than they might have done in earlier days to the visit of the President of the United States. Now, the visit nonetheless has proceeded. President Trump has met with Xi Jinping. It doesn't seem, as far as I can tell, that any great announcements are going to be made as a result of the visit. Trump and Xi had a meeting that lasted for 2 hours. President Xi seems to have been particularly concerned to emphasise to Trump the importance of the issue of Taiwan and the extent to which the entirety of the US-China relationship ultimately revolves around the question of Taiwan. Well, whether Trump got the message, whether he understood what Xi Jinping was saying, it's difficult for me to say. There have been previous occasions when Xi Jinping has tried to make precisely that same point to previous American presidents. He did this all the time with Biden. And as I well remember, Biden always gave him assurances that on the issue of Taiwan, the United States position that Taiwan was an integral part of China had not changed, even as President Biden would ramp up his continued support for Taiwan, continued weapons sales to Taiwan, talk from President Biden of a security agreement between the United States and Taiwan, which no one seemed to know existed and whose existence if it does exist, had never been previously publicly disclosed. Anyway, even as Biden gave assurances to Xi Jinping that US policy continued to be that Taiwan was part of China, Biden basically gave those assurances and went away and continued to ramp up support for Taiwan in ways that, as far as the Chinese were concerned, contradicted those assurances. In fact, things between Biden and Trump eventually got so bad that I remember reading in a Chinese readout comments which basically said that Xi Jinping, in his invariable, impeccably polite way, all but called Biden a liar to his face, just to say. Anyway, I don't think that the relationship between Xi Jinping and Trump has so far sunk to those poisonous levels. In general, the two men have had a reasonably friendly relationship, though it has had its ups and downs. But from the public statements that the Chinese have made, it doesn't seem that the Chinese have given an inch on any of the key issues that they are maintaining the same consistent line on trade, on foreign relations, on the balance of power between China and the United States, on relations with Iran and Russia that the Chinese always do. And there was a long editorial about this visit in Global Times, Chinese newspaper owned by the People's Daily, which, as I pointed out many times, essentially is the English language voice of the Chinese government. And well, the editorial talked up the relationship with the United States. It said that this relationship has a bright future. That was the title. But buried within this editorial, there was this rather chilling phrase. It says, China has consistently taken head of state diplomacy as strategic guidance and actively promoted efforts to build a China-US relationship that is strategic, constructive, and stable. Facts have repeatedly shown that as long as the consensus reached between the two heads of state is fully implemented, China-US relations can overcome differences and continue moving forward steadily. In recent years, most difficulties in bilateral relations have largely stemmed from the fact that some people in the United States cling to the mistaken logic that one side outcompetes or thrives at the expense of the other, thereby deviating from the consensus between the two leaders. So, what the Chinese are saying here is that yes, they work very hard to establish good relations with US presidents. They come to all sorts of agreements with US presidents, but they repeatedly find that those agreements are not implemented, that after the president has gone away from the meeting, things begin to go wrong because there are lots of people in the United States who basically have an antagonistic attitude towards China and see the relationship between the United States and China in zero-sum terms. What is good for the United States is bad for China, and vice versa. And this comment could be taken to imply that the Chinese don't really expect very much of this visit, that whatever Donald Trump says to Xi Jinping, whatever assurances of friendship and of good intentions come, the reality is that as soon as Donald Trump returns to the United States, it will be business as usual. Now, all of this, of course, is taking place, this entire meeting is taking place at a time when the United States is in a conflict with Iran. Iran is a friend of China. It is a country that exports oil to China. It is a country which is a member of BRICS, a grouping of states with economic relationships. By the way, BRICS is currently conducting a meeting at foreign ministers level in India, chaired by the Indian Foreign Minister, Mr. Jaishankar. Lavrov is in India attending this meeting, just to say. Anyway, the Chinese are, as I said, part of BRICS. They're friends of Iran. They have an oil relationship with Iran. They've been planning to invest heavily in the Iranian economy. And the United States is, of course, currently attacking Iran and blockading Iran. And, well, the Chinese are fully aware of the many reports and the many articles which appear all across the American media, particularly that part of the media which is concerned with foreign policy, that the war against Iran is ultimately part of some grand strategic master plan of the United States to try to gain control of all the oil export countries, in effect, in order to put pressure on China by threatening to cut off its oil supplies if China does not comply with the dictates of the United States. Now, whether that is actually true is a big question. The question is not whether it is true. It is what the Chinese see. And they are well aware of all of these articles. And they are well aware that these articles, to put it mildly, suggest a very hostile, extremely adversarial attitude by powerful people in the United States against China. And the Chinese are aware that in terms of these people in the United States, who do wield indeed a great deal of power, the war against Iran is ultimately also part of a global US strategy ultimately directed at China. And again, if we go back to those words in the Global Times editorial, there is the fact that some people in the United States could cling to the mistaken logic that one side outcompetes or thrives at the expense of the other. Well, what is that, if not at some level at least, a hint that the Chinese know perfectly well what the true agenda behind the war the United States is waging against Iran is, and that that agenda is directed at themselves. So anyway, we can see that behind the gracious words and the banquets and the ceremonies and the admittedly rather brief meetings, there are all of these tensions there bubbling away just below the surface. For the record, I don't think very much is going to come from this meeting. President Trump has brought a huge delegation of people, business people with him to China, Elon Musk, Tim Cook and others. They will no doubt be doing much of the real business, cutting deals with their Chinese counterparts. Some people are going to make a great deal of money out of this trip. Some people are going to land some very juicy contracts out of it. But at a geopolitical level, at a level of heads of state, I don't think that this meeting is going to resolve any of the key issues. I don't think it is going to resolve the question of China's strategic build-up, Taiwan, the issue of Taiwan, control of the East and South China Seas, the questions of Ukraine, of Iran, of tariffs and trade policy, of rare earths, of all these other complex topics that beset the relationship between China and the United States. And when Donald Trump does eventually return to the United States, we're going to see that nothing very much has basically changed. The more substantive meeting, at least from a Chinese point of view, is the one that Vladimir Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, has said is coming soon. And that is the visit to China of the Russian president, Vladimir Putin. Unlike this meeting between Trump and Xi Jinping, the Russians, Putin, will almost certainly come with large numbers of key officials, many ministers of the Russian government, business people also, of course, and there will be lots of detailed, in-depth discussion about industry cooperation, about military industrial cooperation, about intelligence sharing. There will be coordination of foreign policy positions, and almost certainly there is going to be a major deal on gas and oil supplies to China from Russia. So that meeting is coming, and that is ultimately going to be a substantive one. Most importantly, from this meeting between the Americans and the Chinese, I see no sign that the Chinese are prepared to relax controls on exports of rare earths. I see absolutely no sign that the Chinese are prepared to reverse their recent decree that Chinese refineries henceforth make their oil purchases completely ignoring US sanctions policy, allowing for greater imports of oil from sanctioned countries like Russia and Iran. And I certainly don't see China giving any commitments or promises to the Americans about changing its policies either towards Russia or Iran either. So there it is. That is my take so far on President Trump's visit. We will see whether the situation changes over the next 24 hours, but I doubt that it will. And, well, President Trump will then be returning to a United States with a rather empty trip to China behind him. And, of course, an ongoing war within the Middle East, where he has to make difficult decisions about whether to negotiate or to escalate, and a continued conflict over Ukraine with Russia, a conflict which one senses at times that Trump has wanted to walk away from, but which remains as intractable as ever, with the fighting there continuing and indeed intensifying. Now, over the last 24 hours, we've had a fair amount of information about the situation in the war. But we've also had a number of very strong statements from the Russians. The Russian Security Council Secretary, Sergei Shoigu, who is Russia's former defense minister. He was defense minister at the time when the special military operation began. He has repeated that the Russians hold the initiative right across the contact line. They're continuing to advance. He says that all of Lugansk region is indeed under Russian control. Only 15% of Donetsk region remains to be captured. And, well, he made it fairly clear that he expects all of this territory to pass under the control of Russia very soon. He did say that Russia remains open to negotiations, but he spoke again, it seems to me, with little conviction. And you could argue that actions in wars always speak louder than words. And one of the ways the Russians have spoken is by conducting over the last 2 days what appears to be the biggest single combined drone and missile strike that Ukraine has ever experienced. According to some reports that I have seen, in excess of 1,600 drones, Garand drones, and other types of drones participated in this attack. And they have come in waves. Kiev has been particularly hammered. There appears to be no region in Ukraine which has not been affected by this drone attack, at least to a certain degree. Importantly, part of the attack, a major part of the attack, has taken place in broad daylight. Missiles, Russian missiles, have also been launched. A wide range of targets, transport, storage, energy facilities, drone production facilities, airfields with fighter jets have been attacked over the course of this attack. And, well, many people are commenting about the almost complete absence of any visible air defense from Ukraine. The Ukrainians do claim that they've shot down a large proportion of the drones, but the number of impacts, the scale of the attack altogether, the video footage and the photographs provided by people in Ukraine on the ground, cumulatively, these tell a different story of a massive Russian attack which has overwhelmed Ukrainian defences to the extent that they still exist. One can almost speak of the Ukrainians being submerged under the tide, an attack that has inflicted significant damage right across Ukraine, with the capital, Kiev, being especially heavily targeted, and providing proof that with US Patriot missile deliveries now on indefinite hold, as the United States rushes to try to rebuild its arsenal after the conflict, after the fighting with Iran. Well, with that situation, there is essentially no Ukrainian air defense to speak of anymore. There have been some reports of some F-16s and Mirage fighter jets taking off and attempting to intercept this wave upon wave of incoming Garand drones. But, well, given the fact that fighter jets are only able to carry a limited number of air-to-air missiles, and their cannon can only be used to a limited degree, well, there's not much that they can do against a drone attack that has something about it of the quality of a tidal wave. Now, interestingly, this attack has not all happened in a compressed period of time. The Russians have been sending waves of drones in at intervals. So the attack has taken place over a period of 2 days. We do not yet know, as of the time of making of this program, that the attack is fully ended. It may be that we're going to see further waves of drones and missiles over the next few hours, overnight. Well, we shall see. And these attacks, attacks of this kind, do have an effect. There's been reports of fuel shortages across Ukraine. Apparently the supply of fuel, for example, to the army itself on the front lines is affected, at least to a certain degree. And anyway, for Ukrainians, the sight of these waves of drones operating above their country without any apparent resistance must itself be psychologically demoralizing, or at least so I would have thought. Anyway, that is the attack on the sky, from the sky. The Ukrainians do, of course, continue to conduct drone strikes inside Russia of their own. They did so last night, so far as I can tell, with limited results, very limited effects. The Western media, I've noticed, in recent months, talks incessantly about the supposedly increasingly successful Ukrainian drone strikes in Russia. They say far less about these far more powerful and far more effective Russian drone strikes on Ukraine. Again, the nature of the coverage is, in my opinion, giving a profoundly distorted impression over what is really taking place in the war in the sky. Now, all of this is taking place in conjunction with renewed Russian attacks by land. I saw an article in the Financial Times which spoke about how the Russians have smashed the ceasefire with this enormous drone and missile attack, and how the Russians have effectively ended the ceasefire. This is again, frankly, a misrepresentation. The ceasefire was only intended to last 4 days, and there is no doubt that the attack took place after it. But the Ukrainians, Zelensky himself, are, I think, validly making the point that a combined drone and missile attack by the Russians on this scale is at odds with the argument that the Russians expect the war to be ended anytime soon. Now, let's quickly turn to the situation on the front lines. There's been significant developments there. There's more reports that the Russians are on the brink of smashing through the last line of defense of Orekhov from the east. On the Russian army, if these reports are correct, and I see no reason to doubt them, are going to be at some point within the next few weeks through the last lines of defenses, able to start attacking Orekhov from the north and east, even as other Russian forces have already been attacking Orekhov from the south and west. It looks as if, however, the big attack on Orekhov, the storming operation of Orekhov, is indeed going to take place from the east. And I think this will be a decisive moment. Orekhov was the town from which Ukraine launched its summer offensive of 2023, the one which was supposed to break through to the Sea of Azov and to the Black Sea, the one that would cut the land bridge between Crimea and Russia, the one that would put Crimea, in effect, under siege, the one which many expected would win Ukraine the war. Well, the Russians defeated the 2023 offensive, but since then, Orekhov has remained under Ukrainian control. If the Ukrainians lose Orekhov, then any possibility of a successful Ukrainian offensive towards the Black Sea, towards the Sea of Azov, of any even imaginary possibility of Ukraine recapturing cities like Mariupol in Donetsk, Militopol in Zaporozhye region, Berdyansk, of breaking through to the Black Sea, of recapturing Crimea itself. Any ideas of that kind will have gone forever. The fall of Orekhov will decisively confirm that Crimea is not only Russian, but will permanently, from now on, remain so. And of course, the fall of Orekhov, as well as representing this enormous psychological blow, will open the way for the Russians to attack the great city of Zaporozhye on the banks, the eastern bank of the Dnieper. Russian drones are now, and I mean FPV drones, are now regularly overflying Zaporozhye city. And of course, the loss of Zaporozhye city and its key industries and the establishment of the Russian army in central Ukraine on the Dnieper would be an existential moment for Ukraine and potentially would open the way for a further Russian advance northwards towards the other big city on the Dnieper, the great industrial city of Dniepro, and for a further advance by the Russians, if they choose to cross the Dnieper towards Odessa, something which, by the way, I have no doubt at all that they do, in fact, plan to do. So anyway, this is the battle that is now taking place in Zaporozhye. The other big battles are continuing to take place in Konstantinovka and in the Slavyansk Kramatorsk area. And, well, in Konstantinovka, we're getting further reports of a further deterioration in the Ukrainian position. The Russian war reporter Marat Khairulin has been talking about the importance to the remaining defences of Konstantinovka, of certain villages that Ukraine has been holding east of Konstantinovka. One of these villages is a place called Nikolaeva. The Russian Defense Ministry reported this morning that that village has now fallen and is under Russian control. A number of commentators, including Khairulin, have pointed out that the capture of these villages, Nikolaevna being, as I said, the first, has catastrophic implications for Ukraine for two reasons. Firstly, it tightens the continuing tightening encirclement of the Ukrainian grouping in Konstantinovka itself. As to that, there have been further reports of actually quite rapid Russian advances inside the city limits of Konstantinovka itself, suggesting that through lack of supplies and reinforcements and those sort of things, the Ukrainian defences in Konstantinovka are now becoming increasingly ragged. But beyond that, the capture of these villages to the east of Konstantinovka has the further effect of potentially surrounding a sizable Ukrainian force which is located between the city of Konstantinovka and the town of Chasov Yar, which the Russians captured last year. And this force has been, from time to time, attempting to conduct attacks towards Chasov Yar, without, it must be said, a great deal of success. And it's established many fortified positions in this area between Konstantinovka and Chasov Yar. But the Ukrainian troops, and it's believed that they number several thousand, who are in this area, now also risk falling into a cauldron. So a double encirclement. One is of the Ukrainian troops who are still holding out in Konstantinovka itself. The second is of the Ukrainian troops located between Konstantinovka and Chasov Yar. I'm completely unable to say how many troops are involved in either case. But my guess is that we're looking at numbers in the thousands rather than in the hundreds. I don't know how Ukraine deals with that problem. So Konstantinovka, the situation there becoming very difficult. And there are also reports that also to the east of the Slavyansk, Kramatorsk conurbation, the Russians now control around 40% of the key village of Rai Alexandrovka, located on a hill overlooking the supply roads from Kramatorsk to Konstantinovka and the other town to the south of Kramatorsk, which is Druzhivka. So again, altogether, it looks as if Ukraine's position in the Slavyansk, Kramatorsk area is deteriorating fast. Now, here I do want to make a further point, which is that this is a row of fortified towns. You could argue that the first in the sequence was actually Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, Konstantinovka, Druzhivka, Kramatorsk, and then up in the north, Slavyansk. Pokrovsk, Mirnograd have fallen. Konstantinovka is in the process of falling. Every time one of these towns falls, the defense by the Ukrainians of the next one in the sequence becomes more difficult. Because what makes this fortified line so difficult to penetrate is precisely that it is a line, one that the Ukrainians can move troops around in, and one which has multiple supply roads. With each loss of a town, the line becomes smaller, it becomes easier to encircle, it becomes easier to cut off the supplies to the remaining towns, it becomes easier for the Russians to focus on their forces or whatever Ukrainian defenders there still are in whatever town continues to hold out. So the Battle of Pokrovsk took several months. The Battle of Konstantinovka has also done so. The battles of Druzhivka, Slavyansk, and ultimately Kramatorsk itself may not take anywhere near as long. Just to say. So they could start to fall like a row of dominoes. Now, Zelensky correctly says that it is these movements, these actions by the Russians, the continued advance in Donbass, the enormous drone and missile strikes that the Russians are now carrying out across Ukraine, that tell us ultimately a lot more about genuine Russian intentions in this war than the words we still hear from Moscow from time to time about Russia being willing to agree to a peace and to agree a negotiated resolution. And on this one point, I feel that Zelensky is right. Now, despite the deteriorating situation on the front lines, and by the way, in the Ukrainian economy and in the sky, I suspect that Zelensky's major focus today is not what is going on the front lines or the deteriorating economic situation, but rather the prosecution of his former chief of staff, Andrei Yermak. Now, Yermak has indeed now been charged and charged with money laundering. He has been presented with, I believe, around 150 volumes of evidence by NABU. A court has refused to release him, and he's now been remanded to jail for 60 days whilst the investigations of him continue. He's been embarrassed by suggestions that in deciding appointments, he sought advice from a fortune teller, which is actually quite extraordinary. He denies it, by the way. Given how close Zelensky and Yermak are, inevitably this is going to worry Zelensky a great deal. Now, there remain questions about the motivation behind this case. You can argue, if you wish, that this is a case brought by outraged anti-corruption investigators and prosecutors, incensed by the existence of corruption in their country. You're perfectly within your rights to believe that, if you wish, but if you do, then all I can say is that I have a bridge to sell you. This being Ukraine, I have no doubt that there is some bigger political motive. And the more I have thought about this, the more convinced I've become that the decision to reactivate the corruption scandal against Zelensky has probably come from Europe, not from the United States, which appears to be largely disengaged from the diplomacy and from the conduct of the war at the present time, but from the European Union, and perhaps specifically from Germany. The European Union and Germany now being the primary funders of Ukraine, and I believe of NABU. So why would the Europeans, who have backed Zelensky to the hilt, including in every confrontation between Zelensky and Trump, why have the Europeans decided to allow this investigation to proceed? Well, it could be that they are also becoming frustrated with Zelensky and about with the way in which Zelensky refuses to negotiate with the Russians or to seek peace with them. I have to say that there is nothing, no statement from Europe, from any European official, which would lead me to think that that was the case. Quite the contrary, actually. Or it could be that the Europeans are concerned about corruption in Ukraine. They repeatedly tell us that they are. But again, they've been intensely relaxed in practice about it up to now. So I can't quite believe that. So what is going on? Why are the Europeans taking the stance that they are? Well, I'm going to suggest two possible theories, which are by no means incompatible with each other. Both might be true at the same time. The first is, as I discussed in some programs I made a short time ago, the first is that the Europeans have decided to slam the door shut on Ukraine's effort to join the European Union. And they need to do things that both provide a valid reason why, and at the same time, frightened Zelensky into compliance. And a corruption scandal provides that perfectly. It shows that Ukraine is not ready for European Union membership, or at least so the Europeans will say. And of course, it also tells Zelensky, we are the masters, you are our puppet. If we say that you can't join the European Union, you have to accept it, because if you don't, well, you see what we can do. We've got your friend Yermak behind bars, and don't for one moment think that we will balk from doing the same to you. That is one possibility, and I think it's a strong one. The other possibility, which is by no means incompatible with the first, has been suggested by my colleague and friend, Alex Christoforou, which is that this is all ultimately a further exercise in tightening by Europe control over the money flows. The Europeans have recently agreed to move forward with the 90 billion euro loan. Supposedly, some of this money is due to be distributed fairly soon. The Europeans want control over how this money is spent in Ukraine. They want this money to be used in Europe, buying European weapons, for example. And they don't trust Zelensky to use this money in the way that the Europeans would wish. So again, take Zelensky down a notch or two, arrest his former friend and number two, show him who's the boss, and that way you control the money and you can see that the money is spent in the way that you want rather than in the way that Zelensky wants. And again, a corruption scandal provides the perfect way to do this. Well, put all this aside, and what I've just been saying are basically guesses, because I don't actually fully know what is going on, and nobody other than those directly involved can do so either. But what all of this is going to do in the meantime is that it's going to make it very difficult for Zelensky and his officials to focus either on diplomacy with the Russians or on the military situation in the front lines. The flow of decisions to the frontal commanders could very well reduce, or those decisions which do get made will be even less connected to reality than they have been up to now, because Zelensky is distracted from the war by worries about this corruption scandal taking place in Kiev at the present time. One of the characteristics of Zelensky when he comes under pressure is that he tends to leave Kiev, he tends to leave Ukraine to go abroad. And interestingly, and by the way, that is exactly what he has now done, even as the Russian drones and missiles come crashing in, even as his former number two and friend and deputy Andrei Yermak is heading for a prison cell. Zelensky is off to Romania to have talks with the Romanian government, perhaps about Moldova or about something else like that. But frankly, it looks like a visit arranged very much in a hurry in order to get Zelensky out of Kiev, which is what I suspect he basically at this time wants to do. So anyway, that's the domestic situation in Ukraine at this time. The absolute puzzle, the abiding mystery, again, is the Europeans. Because currently, they're doing nothing. They have given themselves this alibi that they don't need to do anything because the situation on the front lines is turning in Ukraine's favour. As I've discussed in this programme, this is absolutely, categorically not the case. But anyway, that is what they're saying. They've talked a great deal about negotiations with the Russians recently. Kaya Kallas has had her word on this. She says that if anybody's going to, she's again saying, if anybody's going to negotiate with the Russians, it should be her, which many people would find a comical idea. But to repeat again, there's been no single individual who the Europeans have appointed to conduct the negotiations with the Russians, even though there's been a discussion about this, which now goes back for roughly a year. So, no negotiations with the Russians. Some talk about continued rearmament in the future. But again, Kaya Kallas has now taken to complaining that vast amounts of money are being spent within the European Union to produce weapons. And she can't understand why no weapons are actually being produced, why there is no actual increase in production and supply of weapons. Apparently, Rheinmetall, the German armaments firm, is drowning under a sea of contracts. It doesn't know what to do with most of these contracts because its production facilities and its supply chains can't absorb the strain of fulfilling all of these contracts. I've not heard that they've turned any of them away or publicly said that they cannot meet expectations. After all, doing that might damage their share price, which, unlike that of other German companies, is currently rising. But Kaya Kallas, great mind as she is, has suddenly noticed that all of this wall of money, sea of money, that has been heading towards the arms producers in Europe is not actually producing anything. Now, again, I find this so difficult to understand because I have been predicting that we would be in this position, well, over many months. I've said that there are fundamental structural problems with European industry, that much of it works at a cottage industry level with missiles handmade rather than produced in volume on production lines. That before a rearmament drive can validly take place, there should be, well, first, a comprehensive study to gain an accurate picture of the true state of the European arms industry and of its capabilities. And then a clearly worked out and defined plan to modernize and update and expand this industry and to adapt it for volume production. That, of course, even that process would take years, but the point is that it's not being attempted, and so far nothing actually has been done. So given that Taurus missiles, say, are mostly handmade, much of them is handmade, you can't scale up production because, well, how do you do that if you have a small group of very highly trained, very professional workers accustomed to sewing all the wires in these systems and all of that together? You can't just take people off the street and put them on a production line and expect them to replicate one of those skills in a few days or weeks or months. It would require not just recruitment of a new workforce, but deep training of that workforce. And it would, at the very least, also require expanded and comprehensively reorganized industrial facilities, all of which, of course, already takes time. Anyway, time which Ukraine emphatically does not have. So this is the reality that Europe and the West have never confronted. Here I want to make a point about the course of the war, because one of the things that one constantly reads is that Russia is a far bigger, far richer, far more industrialized, far more populous country than Ukraine, and nonetheless it has been unable to prevail over Ukraine in 4.5 years of war. But the narrative, the story that we were being told earlier on in the war in the West, said a completely different thing, that Western support to Ukraine would redress this imbalance, that it would mean that with the united backing of the entire collective West behind it, it would be Ukraine, not Russia, that would have the material advantage. And when, over the course of this war, that material advantage has never appeared. In the past, this has always been explained by not a lack of capabilities, but by a lack of will. The Joe Biden supposedly did not really want to defeat Putin and Russia, that he didn't comply, therefore, with all of Zelensky's extravagant demands for weapons, that he never provided Ukraine with enough weapons or in a sufficiently timely way for Ukraine to achieve victory. And had he done so, had Biden done that, Ukraine by now would have won the war. You see many such claims circulated. I used to see many such claims circulate. And by the way, from recollection, they reached a peak in 2023 and 2024 during and after Ukraine's summer 2023 offensive. Well, we now see that this assumption, that all of these assumptions that underpinned these claims were wrong. There's been some more data that shows the Russians comprehensively outproducing the entire collective West in every category of weapon, in artillery shells, in guns, in tanks, in armoured vehicles. And the gap actually seems to be growing. And, well, we've now also had the demonstration effect of the war in Iran, with Iran. And this, in some respects, was particularly striking because, of course, the United States attacked Iran using every single weapon that it could, Tomahawk missiles, JASSMs missiles, bombs, precision-guided bombs. It defended itself with its Patriot missiles and its TAD missiles and its Standard missiles. And in a few weeks, it massively depleted of all of these without any real ability to replace them. And this, by the way, is because, exactly as in Europe, most of these weapon systems are also manufactured in the United States, largely by hand. So we find ourselves in a situation in the West where clearly will and GDP numbers are not enough to prevail over the Russians on the battlefield. So in Europe, our response is twofold. We bury our heads in the sand and pretend that Ukraine is winning after all, even though the facts on the ground tell a completely different story. Or we talk about rearmament and spend vast amounts of money doing it in substitution for taking any action that might conceivably make our situation better. One way of reading that Financial Times article, which I discussed at length, the one that said yesterday, my video yesterday, the one that said that after the fall of Donbass, Putin would follow up with more demands for more territory, bigger changes in Ukraine, he would step decisively beyond Istanbul Plus. One way you could read that article is as a further justification for the Europeans to do that which they have consistently done up to now, ever since the start of the special military operation, which is not to talk to Russia. Just saying. Anyway, there it is. Now, I suspect probably that we will see Donbass fall by some point in the autumn. When we get to that stage, the crescendo of panic and hysteria and anger in Europe is going to be off the scale. Whether that finally provokes the Europeans into peace talks, or whether it will instead merely make them even more belligerent, remains to be seen. But it is important to say again that, especially in the current mood, uncompromising mood, in which the Russians are in, if Donbass falls and the Russians make a renewed offer, setting up more demands in return for ending the war, that offer will not be in any true sense an offer anymore. Rather, it should be seen as essentially an ultimatum. Now, I spoke about how Western production of high-end weapons has something of the artisanal cottage industry quality about it, with things, weapons, missiles especially, but also other types of weapons too, being made mostly by hand. And, well, we've had a further example of what that leads to in the war in Iran. I said that the war with Iran has exposed the degree to which America's missile inventories are actually quite limited, and the enormous difficulties there are in replacing those inventories once they've been used up. But we've now had more information, and this comes from an article in the New York Times. And the New York Times is saying that 90% of Iranian launch positions survived the 40-day war, the fighting between the fighting that started on the 28th of February and which continued for 40 days thereafter. Moreover, not only did the launch positions survive, around 90% of them, but it seems that claims that most of the Iranian launchers were destroyed are completely untrue, and that the great majority of them have in fact survived. And it appears that the Iranians have been busy producing more weapons, more missiles and drones to replace those that they lost. Again, it's impossible to find consensus figures here, but it does seem as if this has been taking place. There's some reports that the Iranians have replaced most of the weapons they used during the 40-day war. The Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says that in fact they now have 20% more weapons than they did when the war began. Who knows? It is a case, it seems, that the Iranians are repairing bomb damage in Tehran at extraordinary speed. So maybe they are able to produce new missiles in the necessary volumes, not just to replace those they have used, but actually to increase their stockpile. But the point is, one way or the other, if you take a step back and think about it, what it means is that the Iranians are in a better position relative to the United States, purely in weapons terms, than they were when the fighting started on the 28th of February. They have maintained their stockpiles, and mostly, let's say they mostly replaced the weapons they used. The Americans have depleted their stockpiles and are unable to replace their weapons. If you think about it in that way, then it seems to me that these reports that the United States is seriously thinking of breaching the ceasefire and attacking Iran again have to be wrong. The United States has already shot its bolt at Iran. Without it, it can't afford to go back on the attack again. Now, that does have huge implications, and it may explain a very bizarre thing that the Americans did, which is that they deployed an Ohio-class nuclear submarine, the USS Alaska, to the Straits of Gibraltar. They showed it off. There was much speculation that this was being committed to the battle with Iran. I've mentioned in programs that some Ohio submarines appear to have been adapted to launch large numbers of cruise missiles at a target. I assumed that the Ohio submarine in Gibraltar was one, except that it turns out that it isn't, because the submarine in question apparently is indeed a Trident ballistic missile nuclear weapons carrier, in which case it cannot have any relevance to the conflict with Iran. Even if the US were to go nuclear, were to attack Iran with nuclear weapons, I doubt they would do it in this way, with using this type of capability and submarine. It looks to me as if this was just another empty display of power, one intended to remind the world that despite the depletion of its arsenals, the United States still has the capability to wage nuclear war. As such, it was a message more to the Chinese and the Russians than it was to the Iranians. The Iranians are hardly likely to take this seriously. By the way, I doubt that the Chinese and the Russians will do so either. In which case, the best, most sensible thing, if the United States cannot resume the war, is to talk, and to talk seriously. But that, of course, is the one thing the United States won't do. Well, this is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.